the next sensory input that we can use to bring about changes in our physiology is the experience of sight. There's a lot of research that shows that the information that we take in through our sense of sight also very profoundly influences what's going on in the body. In fact, any sensory input that you have changes the body's chemistry in less than 1/100th of a second. So when you see something, when you hear something, when you touch something or taste something and smell something, the brain chemistry, but simultaneously the body chemistry, responds to that in less than 1/100th of a second. If we knew that, then we would choose the appropriate input that could influence the chemistry in a favorable direction. There is research, for example, that when people look at a natural scene versus an urban scene, that there are different brainwave patterns. If you are out there looking at a natural scene such as a forest or a sunset or a rainbow, then your brainwave will show very distinct patterns that are quite different from the patterns that would come out if you were, say, seeing a violent crime or even an industrial plant or even a parking lot for that matter. So what you see immediately influences what's going on. And in fact, again, there are many research papers now coming out in many journals that show that our experience of sight can influence heart rate, blood pressure, stress hormones, and so on. What I'd like to do in the next few minutes is go over a series of procedures that you can do with the eyes that will, in fact, improve your vision, improve your sense of color perception, and also allow you to experience and access different states of information in your consciousness. Because after all, through our senses, we are accessing information in that field of information, which is us, 99.99% of that empty space which makes up our body is nothing other than that field of information. And we are accessing that field of information through our senses. So let's take a series of procedures with the eyes that you can perform that will immediately result in enhanced sensory perception, will improve your eyesight, will improve your sense of color perception, which gives you much more enjoyment out of life, will also improve your memory, your creativity, your attention span, and your learning ability. All these things are possible just by doing a few simple exercises with the eyes. The first one is very simple. It's looking at the sun with the eyes closed. You would stand in the sun and look towards it with the eyes closed, allowing the light to filter through the eyelids and ultimately stimulating the rods and cones of the retina, which are responsible for light perception. Now, if you don't have access to the sun because it's a cloudy day, then you can also use full spectrum light. These days, full spectrum lights are available at most light stores. Just means that they have all the different wavelengths that sunlight has. And in fact, there's some very good research from England that was published in the journal Lancet, which shows that when full spectrum lights were used in classrooms, children started learning much faster, their grades improved, and not only that, there had fewer number of winter colds, fewer number of infections in the winter. Most of the lights that are used indoors are not full-spectrum lights and therefore are not really as healthy as the light that would have the full spectrum, which would be like the sun. The first exercise, simply looking at the sun with the eyes closed. This stimulates the cells of the retina so that they become more sensitive to light. The second procedure is called watching the colors, and it's a very simple thing. As you're looking towards the sun, you do that for maybe 15, 20 seconds at the most. Your eyes are still closed. You gently massage the eyeballs with your fingertips. And you do that for about 15, 20 seconds. After you've massaged the eyeballs, then you just gently move your head away from the sun and then back towards the sun or towards the full spectrum light, whichever you're using. And then you will experience in your awareness a whole range of colors. If you're a Pitta body type, you may experience more red. If you're a Kapha body type, you may experience more blue. If you're a Vata body type, you may experience more yellow and green. You will experience certain colors, and these colors are basically in your quantum mechanical body, because you're not perceiving outside colors, your eyes are still closed. You're perceiving colors that you're generating inside. And you just hold your attention in such a way that you try and maintain the experience of those colors. So once you've experienced the colors, then try to hold the colors in your awareness. And you may be able to do it for maybe 30 seconds or 60 seconds, or sometimes for a minute or 2 minutes, and the colors change also. So spontaneously they may go through the full range of the spectrum, all the colors from violet to indigo to blue to green, yellow, orange and red. So you may see that. The idea of doing this exercise is that these subtle colors in our perception stimulate those cells of the eyes, which are called cones, which are the receptors for color perception. As a result of doing this exercise, what happens is we find spontaneously, not because we're trying to, that suddenly the colors in our environment become much more alive. They become much more vibrant. They become much more powerful. Our sensory experience becomes richer as a result. We notice the colors more spontaneously. The same sunset viewed by two people could cause a completely different experience. In one person's awareness, rich, vibrant, full of color. In another person's awareness, dull. They're seeing the same thing, but if the light receptors are much more sensitive, then color becomes lively in your awareness. And that spontaneously has a healing effect also. Basically, what you've done is you've looked towards the sun or the full spectrum light for a given amount of time, 30 seconds. Then you've gently massaged the eyes while the eyes are closed. And then you've just moved the head back and forth towards the sun a few times. And then you hold the colors for as long as you can. The total time to do all the procedures that I'm going to go over will take you about 5 or 6 minutes and completely alter your sensory perception. And you do it every day. So now let's move on to some other procedures with the eyes that also are extremely useful. If you do the whole set of eye exercises, then not only can you improve your vision, but if you now have vision which is not normal, if you're short-sighted or far-sighted or have any other refractive problems, these can be corrected. You will notice as you do these procedures that after a period of time you'll need to change your lenses. And you may need to change them 3 or 4 times before you can finally discard them. So if you do these exercises regularly, you should be able to correct your vision. Ultimately, don't need any corrective aids. See, what we consider as normal in our society is many times the psychopathology of the average. And we confuse normal with average. The average is so common, so dull, so uninteresting, we don't even notice it. So when somebody comes along who has really normal sight, it appears extraordinary. With these exercises, by common standards, you may really develop extraordinary vision. The next set of procedures is for the lens of the eye. As people grow old, what happens is the lens becomes less flexible, it becomes rigid. And as a result of that, there's stagnation of fluid inside the lens that ultimately leads to densities and cataracts and so on. So by improving the flexibility, pliability, elasticity of the lens, what we can do is prevent cataracts from occurring in the future, as well as improve our vision and correct either short-sightedness or farsightedness. There are 3 procedures that will help improve the flexibility of the lens. The first one is called focusing, and it's very simple. All you do is you look at an object which is close to you, and then you look at an object which is distant. So you could take your own hand, for example, and just hold it about a few inches in front of your eyes, maybe about 6 inches in front of your eyes, and you look at your hand, and then you look at an object in the distance. Traditionally, it used to be the horizon. So you looked at something which was 6 inches away from you, your hand, you hold it in front of you, and then you look at an object at a distance. You look again back at the object which is close to you, your hand, and then look again at distance. You do that 15, 20 times. There should be no strain, should be simple and smooth. But as you do this, you change the focal length of the lens. And as you change the focal length of the lens, you increase its elasticity, its plasticity, its flexibility. The second thing to do to improve the flexibility of the lens is a procedure that we call distant reading. In this exercise, you take some written material. For example, the written material which is included with this tape series, and you can pin it up against the wall, and then you stand at a distance away from it as far as possible for comfortable reading. And then every day you move back just a little bit, very little bit, that will allow you to read it comfortably. And if you do that slowly enough, you will find that gradually you will be able to read it from the further distance. Till ultimately, you should be able to read it from even the end of the room. Many times when I go on jet planes and I'm traveling, I look at the small print in the front of the aircraft when I'm sitting at the back. And just with practice, after a while, I can read the small print in the front of the plane from the back of the plane. As a result of just doing it. The opposite of distant reading is close reading. You take the same printed material and you read it from as close a distance that you can comfortably, and then gradually bring it nearer you every day till finally you can read it even if it's against your nose. So ultimately your range of vision extends from closer than the closest to farther than the farthest. These three procedures, focusing, distant reading and close reading, are all very useful in improving the flexibility and pliability of the lens. You do all the procedures just once. Every single procedure should take no more than 15, 20 seconds. And when you're done with all these procedures, the whole thing should take you no more than 5 minutes. And also, it is important to bear in mind that if you have corrective lenses, when you do the procedures, it's best to take them off. So the next set of procedures are called fixed positions of the eyes, and these fixed positions of the eyes strengthen the extraocular muscles of the eyes. The extraocular muscles are those muscles which are responsible for movement and coordination of the eyes. Not only do they strengthen the extraocular muscles of the eyes, which is of course a very important aspect of vision and also of coordination, but they also allow us to access different states of information in consciousness. And by doing that, they strengthen our memory, they strengthen our learning ability, they strengthen our attention span, and ultimately all of this leads to a much more stable physiology. So the first fixed position of the eyes is looking to the left and up. Looking to the left and up, and you hold the eyes in that fixed position for about 15 seconds or so. You look straight ahead. First you hold your head so that your eyes are pointing straight ahead, and then without moving the head, you look up and to the left. Now this movement is a movement that people spontaneously make when they are recalling a visual memory. Let's say if you ask somebody, how was the picnic and who was dressed in what colors or what did she look like, etc. When you ask somebody that question and they're trying to recall a visual image, they spontaneously look up and to the left if they're right-handed people. And just doing this procedure, we strengthen our ability of visual recall. Looking down and to the left accesses auditory memory and auditory recall. So if you're recalling a conversation, or if you're recalling some music in your awareness, then you spontaneously, usually, look down and to the left. Now looking down and to the right allows us to access what is called kinesthetic recall, or the experience of touch, the memory of touch. So if you're recalling the texture of a rose petal in your awareness, then that's what you spontaneously do. Vata body types are sensitive to both touch and sound, so they tend to look down most of the time. Pitta types tend to look up and they respond much more to light and to sight and form. And kapha types tend to look towards their nose or towards their tongue in the center, because they're accessing the state of information that comes from smell and also comes from taste. So you can see how you can, even by looking at a person's eye movements, predict whether they're a vata, pitta, and kapha. If you look up and to the right, that's the position of the eyes that strengthens the ability to create new visual forms, such as a creative artist would do. If you look horizontally and to the right, that is the kind of movement a musician or a composer uses when he is creating new sound forms or new symphonies. If you look to the left and horizontally, that's the same as looking to the left and down, recalling auditory memory. If you stare towards your nose, then you strengthen what is called olfactory memories. Olfactory memories are the memories of smell and fragrance that we have. If you stare or just have the idea that your eyes are pointing towards your tongue, that accesses what scientists call gustatory memories, the memories of taste. So you can see that just by holding the eyes in fixed positions, we can access different states of information that exist in our own awareness. As a result of doing this, we strengthen our memory, we strengthen our ability to recall things, we strengthen our attention span, we strengthen our learning ability. And we have done research in our laboratories that show that when people hold these fixed positions, they have what is called increased brainwave coherence on EEG. If you see the EEG, it shows a completely different pattern where the brainwaves have entrained with each other, where the brainwaves show a rhythmic relationship to each other. This feature is called brainwave coherence. And we now know from a lot of scientific studies that increased brainwave coherence is in fact a very important factor in learning ability, in strengthening our ability to learn, whether it's memory or whether it's accessing any other visual information. Multisensory experience improves just as a result of doing these simple eye exercises and holding these fixed positions. A vata person usually has better auditory and tactile responses. A pitta person usually has more visual responses and therefore accesses visual memory much more than any other form. A kapha person accesses more the memories of tastes and smell. But I think if we just do all the exercises, and it takes 30 seconds to hold the eyes in one position and move the eyes through all these different positions, start up left, then down left, then down and right, then up and right, and then horizontally to the left, and then horizontally to the right, then look towards the nose for 30 seconds, then turn the eyes inwards and towards the tongue, and then finally, the last one is, turn the eyes upwards and inwards, trying to look at the space between the eyebrows. And when you do that, then according to the ancient Ayurvedic tradition, what you do is you open up what is traditionally the third eye, which is the eye of intuition. And intuition is heightened awareness. It's just accessing information that normally people don't access. But after all, if consciousness is the field where all information is present, then you just access a little more information, then you become, by common standards, intuitive. Intuition is nothing but heightened sense of awareness. So doing these fixed positions allows you to improve all aspects of learning, all aspects of memory, ultimately makes for a richer, fuller, better life, and also a multisensory experience. So by replicating these eye movements, we strengthen those abilities, which are there anyway, spontaneously. So if you understand that matter or structure is the final thing, before matter is function, before function is intention, and before intention is consciousness. And from consciousness comes this whole thing. They say the eyes are the mirrors to the soul, the windows to the soul, because eye movements always reflect what's happening in consciousness. Thank you. The next sensory experience I want to discuss is the experience of taste. After all, that's one of the most enjoyable experiences in life. When people get underweight or they get overweight, the reason that happens is they've stopped enjoying food. If we enjoy food, then we'll never have a weight problem. In fact, I'm going to suggest a few techniques that if you follow these techniques, and they have to do with eating awareness, you'll never have a weight problem, ever. So these are really very simple things that one does to maximize one's enjoyment of food. Note these simple techniques of eating awareness. The first one, whenever you eat, no matter how much or how little, doesn't matter, it could be one scoop of ice cream or one peanut or one sip of coffee, anything, whenever you eat or drink anything other than water, make a rule that you're going to sit down to do that. So always sit down. Preferably, there should be a chair and a table. Don't eat when you're standing. Don't eat when you're driving. Don't eat when you're walking. Don't eat when you're speaking on the phone, etc. Why would you want to? After all, eating is an enjoyable thing. You might as well do it in an enjoyable manner so you get the maximum out of the experience. Number two, when you eat, don't do anything else. In other words, it's best not to read a newspaper or watch a television program or read a book or try and do a crossword puzzle or watch the evening news or even listen to music, because you want to get the maximum out of the sensory experience of taste when you're eating. That's what makes it enjoyable. Rule number three, eat when the stomach is empty. That is, there is no remnant from a previously eaten meal in the stomach, because that too would interfere with the enjoyment of food. See, what we're doing with all these very simple rules is we are maximizing the enjoyment we could get from the experience of eating. Now, according to basic rules of physiology, it takes approximately 4 hours for all the food to leave our stomach once it's there. Now, in a Vata body type who's hyperactive, it may, in fact, be shorter. Or for a Kapha body type, it may be longer. The food might just sit there for 4 to 6 hours. Generally speaking, though, all we do is place our hand over our stomach or our abdomen, and we can know whether there's food there or not, just by feeling the sensations of the body. And if there's no food, then it's all right to eat. But if there's still food from a previously digested meal, then we wait for the appropriate time to occur. In the beginning, this takes a little practice and may disrupt your meal schedule. But in 3 or 4 days, it adjusts itself so beautifully that you'll find that hunger sensations come at the appropriate times. These are built-in responses. Rule number four, do not put food in the mouth till the previous bite has gone into the stomach. It's such a simple thing to say, but go to a restaurant next time and you'll see that people violate this rule all the time. You can see all the mush in their mouth as they speak and eat at the same time. You should wait till the previous bite has gone to the stomach. And you shouldn't speak when the food is in the mouth. You should speak only when the food is in the stomach. That's another rule to observe. If you just follow these simple rules of eating awareness, you maximize the enjoyment you get out of food, and also your satiety level, the level in the brain where satisfaction is registered, has another threshold. Most people who have weight problems, they seek more intense stimulation from food simply because they do it unconsciously. They're dumping food into their stomach as if it was a garbage can. So as a result, it takes much longer for that satiety level to be reached. And therefore, they eat inappropriately. Now, one of the simple rules that I give my patients frequently is that for your first helping, take about 2 cupped hands full of food, the equivalent of 2 cupped hands. This will fill up about 2/3 of the stomach, leaving about 1/3 for digestion. If after that you still feel hungry, it may be genuine hunger, which means that you haven't eaten enough, or it may be just a memory. If it's just a memory and force of habit, all you have to do is wait for 5 minutes before you take a second helping. Frequently, those satiety levels will reach a certain critical threshold, and if you just wait for 5 minutes, the hunger will dissipate. You're not fighting the hunger, you're not manipulating it, all you're doing is waiting 5 minutes for the second helping. That's all. You should get in touch with the experience of comfort and discomfort in the area of the stomach. And at the point of comfort, you stop. If you go beyond the point of comfort, then obviously you're violating a simple rule of eating awareness. Why would you want to? It disrupts the feeling of energy. If you practice eating awareness even for 1 week, you will feel so much energy coming into you from the experience of eating that spontaneously you will want to follow these rules afterwards. Because the experience of energy gets a bit addictive. You get used to feeling so good, so energetic, that you don't want to violate it. You go to the range of discomfort in the stomach. First, there is a slight discomfort, then you feel tired, then you feel sleepy, and if you really violate it, then you feel quite sick. Many times, people will notice that even though they practice eating awareness, they have very strong cravings for certain types of food. And they can't resist those cravings. Now, according to the principles of Ayurveda, if we have very strong cravings, inappropriately strong cravings, in that we eat always to the point of discomfort, then we may have an eating disorder. But the etiology or the cause of the eating disorder has to do with, again, loss of ability to enjoy food. Traditionally, all food has 6 flavors to it. And what happens is, if your taste buds are not experiencing all the 6 tastes every day, then that causes imbalance in the body. After all, we have these taste buds for a certain purpose. The 6 tastes are the following: sweet, sour, salt, bitter, pungent, and astringent. It turns out that our taste buds are distributed in a certain manner. For example, the tip of the tongue is highly concentrated for sweet taste, the back of the tongue for bitter taste, sides of the tongue more receptors for sour taste, the surface of the tongue more receptive to salty taste. And then the 2 other tastes that I mentioned, pungent and astringent, there are very few receptors for this. And that's why pungent and astringent tastes are in fact quite characteristic, in that even a little bit of pungency has a lot of effect on the body. Also, sweet taste, even a dilution of 1 in 200 can be detected. A salty taste can be detected in a dilution of 1 in 400. A sour taste can be detected in a dilution of 1 in 130,000. And a bitter taste can be detected in a dilution of 1 in 2 million. And therefore, you can see that these tastes are in fact protective, because most poisonous things are extremely bitter. The taste buds can detect that even in a faint dilution of 1 in 2 million. So nature has built in these very protective mechanisms. And also, if we listen to the taste buds, then we'll see that we start enjoying food, the distribution is appropriate for our body types, and spontaneously there's balance in the body as well. One way to sensitize the taste buds is to swish a teaspoon of sesame oil in the oral cavity, in the mouth. This makes the taste buds much more sensitive. One can just swish it around gently for about 2 or 3 minutes and then spit it out and just wash the mouth with plain water afterwards. This lubricates the taste buds, makes them much more sensitive. And when we have more of that experience of delicacy in food, then we tend not to overeat, because satiety levels are reached very easily. And basically, people who tend to overeat have what is called a high flavor threshold, in that they need much more intense stimulation from food because their taste buds are dull. So let's go over these 6 tastes, because what we see in our society is people concentrate just on 3 tastes: sweet, sour, and salt. Classic example, French fries and ketchup. In fact, think of any fast food and you'll see that it is sweet, sour and salt. So what we do is, even though we have taste buds for all the six tastes, we constantly expose ourselves to just those three. As a result, the body gets nutritional deficiencies. The animals in the forest don't have the vaguest notion of what the U.S. Surgeon General said was the minimum requirement for calcium or zinc or whatever. And yet, animals don't get nutritional deficiencies. Animals don't get osteoporosis. The only animal, the only species that gets obese is the human species. And that is because we have lost our ability to respond to internal cues. We are always responding to external cues. And what I'm trying to do here is shift our attention so that we begin to respond to internal cues that nature has built into our systems. So if you constantly expose yourself to sweet, sour and salt, sweet, sour and salt, then you get the cravings. Since you're used only to sweet, sour and salt, you go ahead and take more sweet, sour and salt. That aggravates the craving even more. The first thing to do when you have these cravings is to gently introduce all the six tastes, at least in one meal every day. So the six tastes are sweet, sour, salt, bitter, pungent, and astringent. When I say sweet, I don't mean concentrated sugar, which is bad for anyone. When I say the sweet taste, I just mean the sweet taste that is in things like breads, carbohydrates, rice, milk, cream, butter, even chicken, fish, meat, their baseline taste is sweet. Sour is the taste that is dominant in things like lemon, in yogurt, cheese. Salt needs no explanation. Bitter is the taste of green leafy vegetables, spinach, broccoli, endives. All these have a bitter element to them. And then pungent is the taste of spices. For example, horseradish, or mustard, or just red peppers, black pepper, jalapenos, serrano, all these things that add spice to the food. So any spice is the taste pungent. And astringent taste is the characteristic taste in beans, lentils, and pulses. So Mexican food, for example, when you eat beans, or when you eat lentils or peas, that has a peculiar taste that's unique to itself. That is called the astringent taste. In other words, if your taste buds are exposed to all these six tastes, one meal, for example, where there would be some bread or rice, some green leafy vegetables, of course salt is there, some pungency in the form of some spices, and a little bit of beans or lentils, that would be the six tastes. Spontaneously, the cravings would dissipate because the body is exposing itself to what nature meant it to expose itself to. So just introducing the six tastes to our food will immediately get rid of all the cravings. Now it turns out that different foods will have different effects on different physiologies. For example, if you're feeling hyperactive, then the vata pacifying food will cause a settling down of that hyperactivity. On the other hand, if you're feeling hypoactive, lethargic, lazy, tend to gain weight, then a kapha pacifying food will speed up the metabolism of food. Vata pacifying foods are sweet, sour and salty. Pitta pacifying foods are astringent, bitter and sweet. And kapha pacifying foods are bitter, pungent and astringent. It's very interesting. You can, with a little bit of spice, little bit of mustard, little bit of horseradish, or a little bit of other spices, speed up the body's metabolism by as much as 25%. So a person who has a weight problem, if he just takes a little extra food in the form of bitter, astringent, and pungent tastes, that will alter his metabolism in such a way that it'll make it easier for such a person to lose weight. There's no exercise that would increase the body's metabolism by 25%. And yet spices do that. That's why people start sweating, and that's why people have all kinds of reactions to spicy foods, because they speed up the metabolism. Now, it turns out that while these different tastes are affecting our physiology, they're also affecting our emotions and our psychology. Our language, in fact, reflects that. So we say, sweet love, sweet friends, sweet children, sweet memories. Or we say, bitter enemy, bitter argument, bitter pain, bitter disappointment, bitter regret. Or we say, I'm still smarting, stinging, burning from his pungent remarks. Or we say, so-and-so has an astringent or caustic sense of humor, a dry wit. So we can see that food and the various tastes have an effect not only on our physiology, but on our emotions. In the printed material that is accompanying this tape series, you will see a list of foods that have an effect on different body types. And we can see just by changing our food, we can influence our emotions, we can influence our body's metabolism, we can influence it in such a way that we can either gain weight or lose weight just by paying a little more attention to a different sensory experience of taste. The sense of smell is the next one we're going to deal with. Many times we are responding to smells at levels which are below the level of conscious awareness. The sensory experience of smell is one of the most fascinating because it modifies our behavior and influences our actions and our emotions without us even being aware of it. Many times we respond to a certain sensory stimulus of smell below the threshold of conscious awareness. One can improve one's sense of smell by very gently massaging the inner nasal cavity with just a little bit of sesame oil. So you dip your forefinger and your thumb in a little bit of sesame oil, and then you just rub the inside mucous membrane with that oil, and then you just sniff it once or twice. This lubricates the receptors in the nose and makes for a much more heightened sense of awareness through smell. There's a condition called anosmia, which is absence of smell, makes people much more vulnerable to disease. Not only just food poisoning and accidents, which is understandable, but even more to things like infections and so on. And 80% of the flavor of food is actually because of smell. If you block your nose, many times you won't be able to tell the difference between a banana or a potato or an apple, because the sense of smell and the sense of taste are quite closely linked to each other. Also, bonding between people, whether it's between a mother and her child, or between siblings, or even between a husband and his wife, or between two people, attraction and bonding, is influenced through smell. And in fact, smell is a very important factor in entrainment also. The word pher hormones, pherhormones, pher hormones, are hormones or packets of information that come in the atmosphere. And we're constantly emitting these. So vegetarians smell different than non-vegetarians. Smokers smell different than non-smokers. Even if they haven't smoked for a while, they smell different. If you have fear inside of you, you smell different than if you have exhilaration inside you. The smells are constantly reflecting the psychophysiological connection. There's a very interesting experiment that somebody did several years ago where they stressed some mice through electrical shocks. And then they expose other mice to these mice that have been shocked with electricity, and the other mice get very stressful as a result of smelling the odors that the stressed mice emit. So when you say, I smell danger, you're probably speaking quite literally, because intuition, as I said earlier, is nothing but heightened awareness. And when you say, I smell danger, you're in fact responding to that. Or if you go into a room where people have been fighting and they've been arguing with each other, and you say, I went into the room and I felt the stress in that room. I felt the tension in that room. your sense of smell registered the odors these people were emitting as a result of the tension, the fear, the anxiety, the anger, or whatever. As we improve our sense of smell, and as we become more aware of how senses are influencing our physiological responses, we become spontaneously more intuitive as well. Animals also bond through the sense of smell, and even human beings. A mother bonds with her baby in the first 2 hours after birth through the sensory experience of smell. You can now separate the mother and the child, and 30 years later, bring back an adult human being in front of the mother, and she'll be able to pick out her son out of the 5 people just through the memory of smell, and she does it spontaneously. It's below the level of her conscious awareness. Helen Keller, not only blind but also deaf, she could smell a storm hours before it became visible. Cows can smell a storm before it comes. Farm animals may anticipate earthquakes by smelling ions as they escape from the earth. Animals migrate, and their migration is very frequently through sense of smell. Fish, for example, go back to their spawning grounds as a result of the memory of smell. In California, they made a big industry out of this. What they do is when the fish hatch, they just put a little fragrance in the pool, then they let the fish out into the sea. The fish go out in the 7 oceans. When they're huge, big fish ready to spawn, they come back to the exact pool that they were hatched. What brings them back? The sense of smell. In other words, the sense of smell is a very powerful trigger of memory. Earlier, I was telling you about this experiment that Dr. Spector did, where he trained animals to smell camphor and destroy their immune system, to smell camphor and stimulate the immune system. What was he doing? He was inducing a conditioned response. But that conditioned response exists in our physiologies by itself. We have already linked memories and behavioral responses as a result of all the fragrances and odors and smells that we were exposed to since childhood. You smell a certain bakery and it brings back the memory of your childhood. You smell a certain fragrance, brings back the memory of an old romance, etc., etc. Now, knowing this and linking this to the experience of the body type is something that actually can be used for healing. Because there are certain smells, especially those smells that are linked to sweet, sour, and salty tastes, that will pacify vata tendencies. So let's say you're a hyperactive person, you're an anxious person, and you have insomnia, or irritable bowel, or constipation, or premenstrual syndrome, which are all the features of a vata that's gone out of balance. You can rebalance that with vata pacifying smells or fragrances. And these are basil, orange, rose geranium, and clove. These are the smells that have this sweet, sour, and salty odor to them, in a sense. So they pacify vata. On the other hand, you're a kapha person, hypometabolic, can't lose weight, tends to get high cholesterol, feels lazy all the time, retains fluid, etc. These can be influenced through the smell of juniper, eucalyptus, camphor, and marjoram. These smells will stimulate the metabolic rate. So they're very useful to use as aromatherapy, for example. And all you have to do is take a little bit of the oil that has those basic smells, and you can just rub it in some part of your body. Use it even as a perfume if you want. Or you can use the aroma oil in a dispenser, an aroma oil dispensers available in most health food stores, and these days even in supermarkets. So those smells will increase metabolism and also get rid of kapha disorders. It's interesting, a lot of our treatments for colds and congestions, even over-the-counter drugs, have kapha pacifying smells like eucalyptus. Pitta pacifying smells include sweet, bitter, and astringent and cooling aromas, such as minty smells, sandalwood, smell of any minty flavor, or cinnamon or jasmine. These will have an effect on an aggravated pitta. So somebody who tends to get angry and upset and hot-tempered, then pitta pacifying smells will lower their blood pressure, for example, and in fact lower their heart rate. In general, minty smells are pitta pacifying. Floral smells are both vata and pitta pacifying, and musky smells are kapha pacifying. So we can see that smells also can be used in very powerful ways to influence that part of the brain which is known as the hypothalamus. And this part of the brain is connected with a lot of autonomic functions. The hypothalamus is that part of the brain where sleep-wake cycles are regulated, where sexual urges are regulated, where appetite is regulated, where body temperature is regulated. A lot of these things that happen spontaneously in our body, the thermostats, so to speak, for all these are in the hypothalamus, which is this part of the brain, which is also called the brain's brain. And this part of the brain is directly connected with the smell receptors in the nose. So we can see how this knowledge of vata, pitta, kapha, the body types, can also influence responses in the body. Now, again, in the printed material that you have, you'll find a list of all the smells and for which body type they are most appropriate. And you can use those fragrances either in perfumes or as aroma oils to burn, or even as oils to gently massage your body with.